Lecture 10, Bactria, the Edge of the Hellenistic World.
Hello and welcome back to our series of lectures on the Hellenistic Age. So far in our survey of the Hellenistic kingdoms, we've had an opportunity to look at kingdoms which are all primarily located around the Mediterranean. We've looked at Ptolemaic Egypt and we've seen that the Ptolemies tended to keep close to the Mediterranean at Alexandria rather than having their capital in Memphis or anywhere down on the Nile. And we've also looked at the Seleucid kingdom and we saw that despite the fact that their kingdom ranged over a vast geographic area, they preferred to concentrate their cities and their imperial rule in Syria, right on the edge of the Mediterranean. And then the third of the kingdoms that we looked at was that of the Attalids, who reigned in Pergamum. And once again, we found that though their domain was in Asia Minor, they were still close to the Mediterranean. In fact, the Mediterranean formed the border on the west and the southern side of their kingdom. So that there is this tendency of the Hellenistic kingdoms to stay as close as possible to the Mediterranean, as if they want to stay in close physical contact with Greece itself. And certainly we saw in the case of the Attalids that there was a strong emphasis on connecting their culture with that of mainland Greece, celebrating the glories of classical Greek culture and trying to recreate those, whether it be on their Acropolis or even in the Great Altar, where they attempted to show their connection to Old Greece. This is quite typical of the Hellenistic world, where somehow Greek culture and the older Greek world remains the central focus of the attention of the Hellenistic world. And yet, there is one area that breaks the pattern, and it's because it's so interesting and so anomalous, really, that we need to look at it. It is Bactria, the region which is located far away, 5,000 kilometers from the Mediterranean, 3,000 miles away from the Mediterranean, in the area that we would now call Afghanistan and Pakistan and Turkmenistan, this area far to the east of anywhere that most of the Greeks had ever gone. An exotic area, and an area where, strangely, for about 300 years there existed a transplanted culture of the Greeks flourishing far away from the eastern seaboard. And we'll particularly be looking at Icanum, the farthest outpost, if you will, of Greek culture in the Far East. When Alexander returned from the Indus River to Babylon, he didn't bring with him all of the troops that he'd had on his campaign. He left some behind in the eastern provinces of the newly conquered empire to act as settlers and veterans who would be the linchpin of holding these eastern satrapies for the Greeks. In Bactria and in Sogdiana, which correspond today to the high northern regions of Iran and Afghanistan and the other republics of Central Asia, Alexander left behind Macedonian garrisons and Greek settlers. And it appears as if, as early as 325, there were already about 23,000 men in the area. But they were not happy to be left behind as they saw Alexander returning towards the Greek world, back towards the beloved Mediterranean. And already, before Alexander was dead, in 325, there were revolts in these upper satrapies, as they were called. And so a further military occupation took place in 323 BC when Macedonian veterans were once again sent out to settle the area, to increase the presence of Greeks so they would not feel so isolated and so cut off. Nevertheless, the area remained the very outskirts of the world known to the Greeks. And I think we even get some suggestion of this when we look at the breakup of Alexander's empire. We've already looked in detail at how Babylon went to Seleucus and Egypt went to Ptolemy and Antigonus received Asia Minor. Well, the area of Bactria was given to a Greek named Stasinor, who wasn't even Macedonian. He was a Greek from Cyprus. Now, the inner circle of Alexander's officers had received the choice bits, and the further one went towards the east, the slimmer the pickings from the point of view of the Greek officers. So Stasinor was a relatively low-grade officer. Nevertheless, the first Seleucid king, Seleucus I, reigning in Babylon, and his son Antiochus, were unwilling to cede this territory. We don't actually know what finally happened to Stasinor, but we do know that Seleucus and Antiochus asserted their control of the region. They campaigned vigorously in the region to recapture control of what they called the Upper Satrapies. And as we saw last time, though they had ceded the very eastern border of their empire, their policy in the Upper Satrapies was to pour in settlers and troops to colonize the region. This was probably the most vigorous colonization ever witnessed in the Hellenistic world. And the names of various cities in Central Asia today still evoke this Hellenistic layer of history. Samarkand, Kandahar or Gandhara, originally Seleucid cities named after Alexander. By 250 BC, the region was under the control of a Greek satrap, that is to say, a provincial governor, using the title borrowed from the old Persian Empire, and ruling often almost independently because he was so far away from the central authority of the Seleucid realm. His name was Diodotus, and he profited from this vast distance between Bactria and the Mediterranean to declare himself an independent king. And over the course of the next 300 years, 40 different kings from various Greek dynasties would rule over these Indo-Greek kingdoms of Bactria and Gandhara. Now, evidence concerning the Indo-Greek kingdoms is unfortunately much more limited than the rich documentation that we've had so far from Ptolemaic Egypt and from Seleucid Syria. We don't have dozens of Greek inscriptions, for example, petitions on papyri, letters to the king, responses from the imperial bureaucracy. We don't have this for the Far East. So it's very difficult to reconstruct with absolute detail the history of this area. There are gaps in our knowledge when for even decades we don't know the names of the kings ruling. For a long time, the principal way that scholars reconstructed the history of the Upper Satrapies was through numismatic evidence. And here the coins are very interesting. We have Greek and silver coin, gold and silver coinage from the Upper Satrapies, just as we have in the Mediterranean world. And the coins of these kings, bearing the names of men such as Euthydemus and Antimachus, both good, straight, solid Greek names, these coins show us how the kings advertised their kingship, how they wished to be seen. And the message here was very simple. They wished to be seen as the Macedonian successors of Alexander. In the coinage, there is absolutely no hint of local influence whatsoever. Now, think for a moment about the importance of coinage. The salaries, for example, of soldiers in the garrisons and the money used for major transactions is money that is being coined by the king. And so it is a good propaganda tool for sending out a message to each person in that area as to what the king's authority is. And these kings are not Indo-Greek or Greco-Indian, as we sometimes call them. In their eyes, they are Greco-Macedonian. And the fact that they're 5,000 kilometers away from Macedon is merely an accident of geography, as far as their self-representation is concerned. But more recently, and this is really work of the last generation, we now have some significant archaeological information coming from excavations conducted by the French at Aikanum. And this material really has exploded completely our range of knowledge of what was going on in the Greco-Bactrian kingdoms. So, let's take a little look at this. The excavations here were conducted during the 70s and have been well published during the course of the 1980s and the 1990s. And these are excavations conducted by a French team at a site known as Aikanum. We don't actually even know its Greek name, though presumably it had some sort of name like Alexandropolis or Seleucopolis or Euthydemopolis, but we don't know what it is, so we still call it Aikanum. And it was located on the left bank of what the ancients called the Oxus River, known more recently as the Amu Darya, at the very northwestern edge of Afghanistan. And here, we've uncovered traces of buildings, including a palace and shrines and a heroon, which illustrate the Greek presence here. Now, first of all, the Greeks had not, back in Greece, built many palaces because kingship had died out in Greece hundreds of years earlier. And so the pattern for the palace here is really borrowed from the Persians. It's a Persian-style palace built on a vast scale. At the front of the palace, there is a peristyle hall, that is to say, four halls running around in a large square enclosing a courtyard. And each of these four sides, the hall is supported by 118 columns. So it's built on a massive scale. And this has actually led the excavators to suggest, and I think they're probably right, it's certainly plausible, that this is a royal palace. We'd love to know the name of the king who built it, but I'll bet it was a Greek name. Why here? What about this location? Well, the location here is blessed. It sits along the trade routes running from east to west as part of the Silk Route, and it is an area of high desert and mountains. But in the middle of this high desert and mountains, there is one oasis, one fertile plain of 10 by 35 kilometers, so about 7.5 by about 25 miles. And this is exactly where the city is located. So it's one fertile oasis that the caravans would come to as they were bringing goods across from the east. The area had earlier been occupied, and we know that its fertility had been enhanced by a series of irrigation ditches. The Greeks in the Hellenistic period increased this, made the land even more fertile. Obviously, the Greek settlers here relied on the produce of this land. And they also defended themselves by building up a rampart around the city. Now, Greeks, as I'm sure you're aware, would normally build for preference stone walls for the walls of their city. And they would have done that here had they had the opportunity, but in fact there's very little stone in the area, and so they relied on mud brick. But the size of these mud brick walls gives you some idea of the wealth of the city. The mud brick walls were probably 10 meters high in the estimate of the excavators. That's about 30 feet. And they would have been 6 to 8 meters thick, so up to 24 feet in thickness. This was a city that clearly was wealthy because it was trying to protect itself from the various nomads and invaders that pour through Central Asia at various times. And within this wealthy city, in the middle of its oasis, up in the high plains of the desert, the Greeks established not only this royal palace, but a series of other buildings as well, which advertised their wealth and their prestige. They had a cult shrine, they had a heroon, dedicated probably to some local founder hero, a hypostyle hall, which was adorned with Corinthian columns. You could have been back in mainland Greece looking at the columns in this building. And the houses of the individuals who lived within the city, clearly the local elite, also advertised their great wealth. These houses often measure 65 by 35 meters. These are monumental villas built within the safety of these mud brick walls. And the plan of the houses are very instructive because they look exactly like Greek houses, only on a larger scale. They have a lovely courtyard at the beginning as you come in off the street. Then there is a small court that leads through into the back chambers of the house where there is a living room. Often these will be adorned with, decorated with glorious mosaics, as good as any mosaics that you'll see back in the Mediterranean world, and with bath complexes as well. People who enjoyed their luxury, in other words, the luxury of being a Greek settler. Now, the people who lived here have fortunately left us also some information about what they were reading and what they were learning, which gives us good evidence for the fact that these were Greeks who saw themselves very much as if they were still living back in the Mediterranean world. For example, if you go to Aykanum, we're in Afghanistan now, you will find here the sayings from Delphi inscribed on the blocks at Aykanum. Here's an inscription found there that reads, "These wise sayings of men of former times, the words of famous men, are consecrated at Holy Pytho," that means Delphi, back in the Greek mainland. "And from there, Clearchus copied them carefully and set them up, shining afar in the precinct of Kineas." 3,000 miles away from Delphi. And this is an age before there are trains, cars, buses, planes, and people are inscribing Delphic maxims. "When a child, show yourself well-behaved. When a young man, self-controlled. In middle age, just. As an old man, a good counselor. At the end of your life, free from sorrow." Good aphorisms to live by, learnt from Delphi and now turning up almost in India. The papyri that we have from the area, and we've actually found examples of the books that they were reading, show that the population was reading Aristotelian philosophy and reading Greek poems as well. A completely transplanted Greek culture. And just as if you were in Alexandria on the seaboard of the Mediterranean or back in Athens, you would do some of this reading in the public location of a gymnasium, the place where Greeks went to recreate themselves, to listen to university lectures, to do their reading, and of course to do their exercise in the palaestra, the sandy area. So the elite are living in houses. They're reading books and they're conforming to the social conventions of ordinary everyday life in Greece, but they're doing it over here near the Punjab. It's really quite extraordinary, and it makes one suspect that Plutarch was right when he said that hundreds of years after Alexander's march to the east, the people of Eastern Asia were still, Eastern Asia meaning what we would call Central Asia, were still reading Greek plays, the plays of Sophocles and Euripides. Well, I doubt that the ordinary people working the fields were reading this, but certainly the local elite was, and probably because that local elite was originally Greek. Features of the decoration of the city are really quite astonishing. I remember the first time I was looking at the illustrations of some of the fountains that were found there. As in most Greek cities, the fountains will have a spout which will be decorated to look either like an animal or some other feature to make it slightly more interesting to look at. The water spouts at Ikanum are shaped like dolphins. I don't think that there are many dolphins in Afghanistan. So somebody was bringing the idea of the kind of decoration that you get back in the Aegean. And others that you can see represent theatrical masks. And it has to make one wonder, were people also going to drama performances, watching plays by Euripides and Sophocles? They were reading their texts, why not perform them as well? So we have people here living in country villas adorned with mosaics outside the city centre, as well as those living in, all pointing to a transplanted Greek culture in this small area far, far away. Now, around 200 BC, this Bactrian kingdom, situated around Ikonum, expanded east, and it even annexed territory down in the western side of the Indus Valley. So we see some expansion going on here. And increasingly, this Bactrian kingdom was cut off from the west. And the Indo-Greek kingdoms came to display probably the only example of genuine fusion between Eastern and Western elements that we can see in the Hellenistic Age. Let me try and give you some examples of the kind of fusion that goes on as a result of the increasing isolation of the Bactrian East. One good example is a statue that we have of a Greek character, a character called Marsyas, who is well known in Greek myth. He's a character who had challenged Apollo to a contest, and you should never challenge a Greek god because they always beat you, and Marsyas ends up being flayed alive. The image of him with his hands tied and his skin being torn off is a well-known feature of Hellenistic art. Well, we have one such statue of this sort, of Marsyas, found at Ikanum, but it was dedicated to the local river god, the Oxus, by a character named Atrasokis. Now, as I said, Oxus was the local river god, so it's a Greek statue, but it's a local dedication, and Atrasokis' name is Iranian. So he's probably of a Persian background. His name means he who shines with sacred fire. And he's been identified very plausibly as a priest of the old Persian sacred fire cult. So we've got this extraordinary dedication fusing Greek elements, Iranian elements, and local elements as well. And there's really nothing quite like that anywhere in the Mediterranean basin. So it may well be that the very isolation of the Bactrian kingdoms was the key to this very curious fusion of elements. A Greek statue dedicated by a Persian priest to a local deity. A funny, to our eyes, mishmash of elements. There's another example of this kind of blending, this curious blending of various elements, and that is a pillar which was dedicated to the Hindu gods Garuda and Vishnu, which has been found in the Punjab district of northwestern India. Now, it is inscribed in Prakrit, which is an Indian language. The pillar in its style copies a Achaemenid forms, so it's got a Persian influence, but it was dedicated by a man named Heliodorus. About as good a Greek name as you can get. And Heliodorus, in fact, was an ambassador who dedicated this pillar on the occasion of his visit to the court of the Indian king Bhagabhadra. So, we have this fusion of different elements going on here as well, with a Greek making a dedication that honours Hindu gods but uses Persian motifs. I find this kind of melange, this kind of mixture, very exciting, but it's not typical at all of the Greek or the Hellenistic world. It's really on the exotic eastern corner, and to a lesser extent in the area of Sudan, south of Egypt, where there is a similar blending of Hellenistic and African elements in the kingdom of Meroe, but that's a whole other area. Now, the Bactrian kingdoms that we've been looking at were assaulted by invading tribes known as the Saka, beginning around the middle of the 2nd century BC, and the last Greek king, Heliocles, was replaced by the Saka chief named Arses in 50 BC. So the kingdom really comes to a dramatic end towards the end of the 1st century BC. And in trying to evaluate the significance of the Greek control of this region, because we know basically when the Greek control here terminates, and people have wondered, well, was there any longer lasting influence in the East from this Greek layer? Historians have tended to look for evidence of Greek influence on local traditions. In other words, did the Greeks leave any influence behind after they'd gone? So that, for example, Greek historians will often point to the fact that the monumental Greek sculpture, life-size Greek sculpture, which is well known in the Greek world in the classical age and in the Hellenistic period, is really not very well known in India before this, but comes to be much more popular. And so there is a suggestion that maybe even the decoration of Indian temples, the use of sculpture of the human form may be something that represents a Greek influence moving into India. That's certainly possible. But the line of transmission may also have gone in the other direction, and this is rarely thought about. Is there any evidence, for example, of the Eastern contact influencing Western traditions as early as this stage? Well, we can't be certain about this, but I'd like to throw out a couple of suggestions anyway. One concerns the one of the Greek Bactrian kings who invaded northwestern India was known as Menander. It's a good Greek name. It's the name also of one of the great playwrights of the Hellenistic period. And he's actually well remembered in Indian tradition, so that we have an example of a Greek character from this period who is remembered in Indian tradition, but he's actually remembered as a Greek who converted to Buddhism. And his name in the Buddhist scriptures is not Menander, but Melinda. In other words, his name has been transformed by the contact with the East, rather than an Easterner who's been transformed by contact with the West. That's one interesting example. And Menander was a powerful king who reigned over a large area. So the fact that he converted to Buddhism and became a Buddhist holy man is really quite dramatic. It may be evidence for the Greek Bactrian kingdom losing its Greek character and really assimilating local traditions. That I find very interesting. The other good example, dramatic evidence really for the relationship between the two cultural traditions of Greece and India, is to be found in the career of the great king Ashoka, the king of the Mauryan Empire, which controlled all of northwestern India in the 3rd century BC. Ashoka reigned from 268 to 232 BC. And we have some evidence for the relationship between Ashoka and the Greeks who lay on what to him would be his western border. Well, you remember that Seleucus had already had dealings with the Mauryans back in 305 BC when he'd given up the Seleucid claim to his eastern provinces in return for 500 war elephants. Those 500 war elephants were given to him by Chandragupta, Chandrakotis as the Greeks called him, who was the grandfather of Ashoka. So Ashoka is already used to the idea of dealing with kings from this far west, men who he may not have known personally, but he would have heard about them as he was growing up. Ashoka had virtually had united just about the entire Indian subcontinent, and he'd converted to Buddhism, proselytizing vigorously. So here we have a very powerful monarch in India, aware that there is a world further to the west, quite different from him. And as a Buddhist and as a proselyte, he's interested in sending his ideas out into this new realm. Buddhist edicts were inscribed and they were erected throughout his empire, but he went further than that as well. He also sent embassies out to the Hellenistic kings, embassies that came from India all the way back to Syria to visit Antiochus II, to Egypt to visit Ptolemy II, ambassadors from India that made their way all the way to Macedon to visit Antigonus Gonatas, and Alexander of Epirus as well, located on the northwestern side of Greece. And to each of these great potentates of the Hellenistic world, these ambassadors came bringing messages of goodwill from Ashoka and trying to explain the basic tenets of Buddhist religion to these men. I think this was probably the wrong audience to be trying to talk to. I don't think that Hellenistic rulers were particularly interested in the messages of Buddhism. And so the attempts at conversion were unsuccessful. But it is, in fact, a much more deliberate attempt at conversion than anything the Greeks did in relation to the East. It is the East talking rather to the West. At Kandahar, which, in fact, lay outside of his kingdom and was really part of the Bactrian kingdom of the Greeks, he then set up bilingual inscriptions using both Aramaic, the language of the old Persian Empire, and Greek as well, trying to appeal to the Greek colonists to lead them towards Buddhism. So this is, I think, absolutely fascinating because it means that the sort of religious fusion that's being proposed here, or the cultural influence, the direction is not west to east, but rather from east to west. Again, men may have converted to this, but because the kingdoms eventually collapsed, there was no long-lasting influence in Greek culture, because really it was only an outpost of Greek culture that was in contact with Ashoka. The eventual disappearance of the Greeks, of Bactria, as a separate state, a separate kingdom, and a distinct culture, can probably be put down to a complex set of factors. There is the isolation of the Greeks from the cultural heartland of Hellenism. Geography is a major factor in history. They're simply so isolated. There is the pressure of outside populations on them. The nomads of Central Asia, for example, who were ever ready to plunder the Silk Route. If you're going to have a major trade route with wealth running along it, you're going to have people ready to attack it. And the presence on the very edges of this Hellenistic outpost of a complex and powerful empire, namely that of the Mauryans, itself gripped in a struggle between different cultural and religious forms, namely Vedic culture and Buddhist culture. It was against such a tumultuous background that the Greeks of Bactria gave way, eventually being swallowed up by the world around them and really leaving very little impact on later history. I think that the Bactrians of the Greco-Bactrians of the upper satrapies allow us to indulge in something that historians are not supposed to do, and that is to ask, what if? What if these kingdoms had survived longer? What would have happened? Well, certainly the relationship between East and West would have been vastly different. But I rather suspect that the sheer geographic distance between these provinces and the Mediterranean meant that in the long run, there was really very little possibility of these kingdoms acting as a kind of funnel for Eastern thinking to the West and Western thinking to the East. Instead, what happened was that throughout the rest of Greek history and certainly in Roman history as well, the people of the Mediterranean tended to think of India as being exotic and strange, a place with which they had had a peripheral and temporary contact, but where there was no chance at any long-lasting cultural contact and certainly no chance for any kind of cultural fusion. In a way then, though the Bactrian kingdoms are unlike any other kingdom that we find in the Hellenistic world, the story that we end up finding is exactly the same as what we've seen elsewhere. That for a variety of reasons, both including the exclusive quality of Greek culture and for a variety of other reasons as we've seen, the prospect of cultural fusion in the Hellenistic world was really nil. The Greeks lived as foreigners in this territory. it was far enough from the Mediterranean that they wanted to recreate their Mediterranean world. They would be in this world, but they would never be a part of it.